I'm Hannah Young, and you're listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick, sponsored by Philanthropic Impact.
Welcome and bienvenidos to The Caring Economy with me, Toby Usnick. I'm using a little Spanish today on my podcast because we have as our guest Rodolfo Spielman, who's the CEO of NatureSweet. NatureSweet is a greenhouse-grown produce company that's known for its delicious snacking tomatoes, but the company is also making a big impact in the lives of agricultural workers in North America. Spielman was born and raised in Chile. He studied economics at the very prestigious Pontificia Universidad Católica in Chile and went on to earn a master's in engineering there as well. After graduating and working, he worked his way up through several consumer product companies, including Procter & Gamble, Heinz, Mars, and Del Monte. And in 2019, he was appointed CEO of NatureSweet. Under Spielman's leadership, NatureSweet has become a leader in the sustainable food movement. The company has been recognized for its commitment to social responsibility, including its work to improve the lives of its agricultural workers. In 2018, NatureSweet was awarded the Fair Trade Certification Seal, which means that the company meets rigorous standards for social, economic, environmental sustainability. The company has also been recognized by the Equitable Food Initiative, or EFI, and B-Lab for its commitment to fair labor practices. And I'll ask Rodolfo to talk a little bit about B-Lab certification today. In this episode, we're going to talk to him about NatureSweet's commitment to social responsibility, about agriculture, and we'll discuss the company's growth plans, its challenges, and its visions for the future. But for now, bienvenidos a the Caring Economy, Rodolfo.
Hey, Toby. Thanks a lot for having me here. Appreciate it.
And I apologize for my Spanish. I speak some Spanish, but it's never going to be passable, I think. Anyway, Rodolfo, you and I have talked a little bit, but not as much. I actually spent a lot of time in Latin America, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and beyond, and studied in Ecuador even for a while after university at Católica there. So I always ask my guests, tell us a little bit about your life story, where you grew up, how you found your career path. In a way that's sort of fun and a journey for us.
Grew up in Chile. I lived there for 29 years, except for a small detour to Scotland, but I was 2 years old. I don't think that counts that much. I grew up in one of the smaller cities in Chile, then moved to Santiago, the capital, which in Chile is a big deal because you go from 6 million people at that point in the capital, and you had another, I think, 7 in the rest of the country. So it was really the center of it. And I could say probably two interesting things happened to me in the career. So the first one, it has nothing to do with the business side, but I'm 6'6", which for a Chilean, it's a very tall guy. Yeah. And I used to play volleyball when I was in this smaller city. And by the way, I was a big deal because I was a tall guy. Yeah. I ended up in Santiago in the capital, and just for sheer luck, I ended up in a school that they have fantastic volleyball players. And I was lucky to warm the bench. So literally, that was the first part of learning humility,
yes,
which has been a big deal for me in my life. On, okay, you're not a big deal. You just need to know that. Yeah, and I remember that then they called the national team, and they clearly they didn't call me. Let's be very clear. They called 120 kids. And the coach for the national team asked them, hey, so do you have any teammates in your schools who are tall enough I can teach them to play? And my friend said, yeah, we have this guy, but he's really not good. I'm like, okay. So they invited me because the coach's idea was I can teach a tall guy to play. I cannot teach anyone to grow. And again, 120 kids, my t-shirt should have said I'm the 120. So literally no option to be better than that. And I worked my butt off. I trained every day for over a year, twice a day, et cetera. And I made it to the team and made it to the South American Championship in the A team, et cetera. So for me, that was a big deal of proving that if you put a lot of effort and passion in what you do, you can make it work. And then the second part of this, a bit of a story. So I went to study engineering in Chile. And the way you study in Chile is a bit different than the US. So if you want to study engineering, it's 6 years, period. Yeah. And the business model, in fact, they haven't thought it well enough, because instead of assuming that they want you to graduate, so you pay all years, they actually graduate a bit less than half of the people who enter, because wow, this is supposed to be a really tough career. And if you get the degree, you made it. And I was pretty good on everything, I wasn't great at anything. So when I took the what we call the SAT type test in Chile, I was top 20 in the country, but not because I was great at anything. I was really good on all the separate tests. I entered engineering when, again, it wasn't that relevant that I knew history and I could read a lot of books, etc. Those guys could dance around me on math. So it was another extremely humbling experience going from, hey, you're really smart to you are not even close to good enough. So another one that long nights, lots of coffee. And after a long time, so I was able to get the career. Then I did a master in engineering and I went from there. But for me, what I learned in engineering, if you ask me to build a bridge today or something like that, please don't do that. Don't call me. I'm not your guy for that. But what I learned is I learned to learn. I learned that there's always a lot of people around you who are extremely smart. And I also learned that the formulas don't give you the answer all the time. So this idea of taking a step back and trying to figure out how do things connect is more important than what is the right formula to use at that point in time. So that's a little bit of my career. Yeah. And then I went into business because I liked it more than engineering all the time. So
So going back to your childhood, were you one of many children? Were you an only child? Did your parents present you as the boy genius, or were you sort of competitive with siblings?
Oh, not even close. So I have an older brother and a younger sister. And my dad was in the Navy. And my brother went to the Navy. So let's be very clear, I was not the golden child. Yeah, so because my brother is like super smart guy, by the way, ended up coming to Annapolis here in the US for years. So the guy is really brilliant. My sister was rock star in school. So clearly I was the guy. And in fact, I was probably the guy my parents might have been the most worried about because I was not great following rules.
Yeah,
it's a longer story, but let's say that I was suspended a few times from high school and things like that. So I had some challenges with authority. So the way, and actually now that I work a long time, I realize I do have problems with authority when it's this is it without rational. So I always question why things were happening.
Yeah,
and when you're a 15-year-old kid, that didn't fly too well. In the school, but with Catholic schools and things like that. Yeah, but no, so I was very lucky, great family. My parents are both alive in Chile. And again, I had a great, great, great growing up.
That approach to authority seems to resemble your statement, which I really liked, about formulas. And formulas are what they are, right? But authority is, in a sense, formula. Like you follow the rules and that's the formula. And so can you comment a little bit more about that? I wonder, for example, today when your own children or your own colleagues question authority, do you see yourself in that? Are you a little bit more empathetic? How do you yourself deal with those who come to you with questions about your authority?
It's a great question. So I actually take a very different approach. So let me give you a different idea. So when I joined NatureSeed, I gathered the leadership team of the company and said, hey guys, so let me be very clear. I don't know anything about agriculture. So the odds of me making every decision in this company are zero. I need you to make decisions by yourselves. I'm here to support you and I'm not here to triangulate. I'm not anybody's dad here to go and solve the issues. If you have a problem, let's all come together and we'll solve it. But this is what I expect from you. So at the end of the day, the way I manage authority is by having very clear expectations of my team, and then giving them all the equipment or materials and direction for them to do the job. Yeah. And so net, I don't use the, it's my authority, damn it. We have to do it that often. It's not my style. Having said that, there are some times that you have to do it. And the point is, if you don't do this often, people understand that when you do it, it's serious, which is actually very similar. You asked me about my family. So if you ask my kids, who's the one ruling my house? I'm not even close to get a vote. So I have three kids and my wife is the one who actually rules the house, makes all the decisions. But my kids also know that if I get upset, now this is serious. So if I get like, okay, sit down, we need to talk. They're like, Okay.
So you had this stellar career with these major multinationals, and I wonder how that came about and what made you move from one to the next.
So it was always looking to grow. Yeah. So let's start with Procter & Gamble. So I was very lucky to be hired by Procter & Gamble. In fact, I was hired by a joint venture of Procter & Gamble and a Chilean company. And because I was always raising my hand on, hey, there's an opportunity, can I go? If this is here, can I go? I ended up going to open the Bolivian market after being in the company 6 months. So it was the general manager of the joint venture, the head of sales, and this little guy from marketing who had been in the company for 6 months. And after we did it, they told me, okay, you need to move to the actual Procter & Gamble. So move there. Yeah. Then, making a long story short, a former boss from Procter came to the US to open a new division in Heinz. And Procter was sending me internationally at the same time to a place I didn't want to go to. Yeah. So we got into this back and forth where the guy offered me to come to the US, then Procter counteroffered, sending me to a really cool place. And I remember I asked Procter, so what do I have to do to become a director? And he told me, hey, you're doing great, so it's probably going to be 6 years. And I said, okay, that wasn't my question. I said, what do I have to do? Not how long do I have to wait? Right. I was like, no, you are again the top of the generation, so it's 6 years. So then I called the Heinz guys and said, what do I have to do? And they named what I needed to do. I said, and you might not be able to do it. And by the way, if you don't do it, it is what it is. You're going to be stuck as a brand manager. I was like, okay, love it. So let's go there. So it was an opportunity of having a challenge. So that's how I moved to Heinz. Yeah, I did become a director after 6 months. So I was very happy with that. At some point, Del Monte bought my business. So that was not a decision. I just moved with the business. Yeah. And the reason why I left Del Monte was also I was looking for a challenge. I wanted to be a general manager to become a CEO at some point. And in Del Monte, the structure that didn't allow it. It was fully functional up to the CEO of the company. So I joined Mars, and it's a longer story, but let's keep it simple, and ended up being the general manager for the Caribbean and Central America.
Wow.
So talking about a fun job, imagine 37 countries selling chocolate and pet and rice, and the messes were amazing. So you go from certain countries where, again, obviously we didn't do it, but you were trying. People were trying to bribe you, or by the way, people were trying to kidnap your associates, or by the way, the chocolate actually melts in the Caribbean, so kind of a big issue when you're selling chocolate. So fantastic, yeah. We had a great team, did a good job. We found that there's been some issues in the company. We cleaned it up,
yeah.
And because of that, Mars moved me back to the U.S. To run a company that had a global scope within Mars, which was a neutral company, a pet company. Mm-hmm. The reason I left Mars is because it got to a level that it was too political for me. And when you go very high on a multi-global company, which is, by the way, fantastic company.
Yeah.
But it part of the job is politics and not really what I wanted to do. So I moved to another company, which was really interesting work, and I learned a ton. But I realized that it was all about delivering the quarterly earnings. And don't get me wrong, it's super important to deliver your earnings. So there's no debate on that. But that should be a result of you doing the right thing, not an objective as a company. So I was getting disillusioned with this idea of, did I do all this in my life just to deliver earnings? And when the Nature Seed opportunity came, I was like, okay, this is perfect. This is it.
Yeah.
The opportunity to prove that it's a result, not an objective, and that's why I took it.
Yeah, each of those pivots is fascinating, Rodolfo. One of our earlier guests on the show 3 years ago was Damon Jones, who you may have worked with because he was still the chief marketing officer at P&G. He's been there for, gosh, at least 20 some years, I think. But I think about P&G, I think about Heinz, I think about Mars. These are stellar brands with incredible training, if you will, for their employees, as I've come to believe. Just as I had that kind of experience with my time at American Express and New York Times Company, Christie's. And I think it's a hard thing in my experience to leave what looks like the plum job or the great brand. But I like the way each time you moved, it was really a sort of a educational move, a next step move, right? You weren't complaining about your brands at all. You're just saying that you're growing beyond, say, political discussions in an organization like Mars, or wanting to get beyond just doing the quarterly profit drive to something higher purpose. And so I think that's a really good story to share with our listeners, because we're kind of responsible for our own development and our own growth, don't you think?
I agree 100%. And I think that you're nailed at a point that's super interesting, because right now, and in fact, I had a conversation with my head of marketing last week about this. She was asking me, hey, people seem to start moving very often from one job to another, and that seems to be the trend.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, well, I said, that depends. If they're not learning, they absolutely should be moving.
Yeah.
But if we give them enough to learn, enough to keep developing, then they don't need to move. Yeah. So this is this whole theory of, again, you don't have to stay in a place that you stop learning. Why? But, and that's what has, you're right, what drove most of my changes. Yeah. And I always joke that when people started to behave as if they would know everything. And I remember many meetings, I told people, like, man, it has to be boring to know it all. Yeah, because that means you have nothing else to go for.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, normally I told you, you know, some problems with authority that didn't fly too well. As you said.
Yeah.
But the whole idea for me was always, as you said, if I'm not learning enough or I have another learning opportunity, let's go for it.
Yeah. And also, you know, we should rely on our managers and our employers for some of that, but it can't be all of it. I sort of position myself now as a millennial whisperer, because I think in some ways the millennial generation is no different than anyone before. We all want to know that we matter, that we can contribute. But I think there's less patience today for younger people to kind of tough it out in certain places. And I think that's part of the reason we see the movement we do. But when you take an active interest in your employees' well-being for the long term, not just the immediate, I think that's where I have success with millennial employees, because I've always taken a long view with the teams I manage. It's not just, you work for me, now you do this. It's more like, well, what are your long-term objectives? What are your passions? What are you happy in your personal life? I don't go across boundaries where I shouldn't, but I've always believed in making as good an effort to have your employees be happy holistically in their home life, as in their professional life, because as you know, they'll bring to the office what's not resolved at home, and that's never productive. Would you agree?
I 100%. So at the end of the day, you don't, it doesn't exist that you are here between 8:30 and 5, and you're a whole person, a whole human being. And for me, I'm actually not great on, I'm a bit introverted. I know it doesn't show like that, but
yeah.
It's things you actually have to develop when you become a CEO, but to show a bit more introverted. But I try, I'm very respectful of not crossing.
Yes.
But on the other side, I'm always in, how can I help you if you need anything? So I even today in the morning, without getting into the details, one of my direct reports sent me a note saying they have a problem. I'm trying to figure out how to get there, and send out back, hey, take care of your family goes first. And absolutely. By the way, we have a big issue going on that he actually needs to solve, but it's like, don't worry, take care of your family first, then we'll deal with the rest. And when those things happen, I think that every one of your associates or your partners know that you really do care.
Yeah, actions speak louder than words. Ladies and gentlemen, today on The Caring Economy, we have as our guest Rodolfo Spielman, who is the CEO of NatureSuite. Rodolfo, can you give us a quick sort of overview of NatureSuite? And then I want to talk about why it's the greatest company in the world, in your view.
Perfect. So NatureSuite, we're the largest vertically integrated produce company in the US, actually in North America. Yeah, and let me give you a very quick thing. So the way most, and I'm oversimplifying by the way, but most produce companies operate is you separate the growers from the commercialization companies, because they're two very different businesses. Now, that creates a couple of challenges. First of all, you don't care that much about each other. Yeah. The other is the person managed supply is different than the one managing demand. As you know, if supply and demand move, price moves, which means all the prices move all over the place, and you end up in what is called a commodity market. Mm-hmm. When you end up in a commodity market, that means that quality is not that relevant, and there's a lot of things that start coming down. We chose to be vertically integrated because, as a company, the only reason why we exist is because we're committed to transform the lives of the agricultural workers in North America. Now, if you want to transform lives, well, you better be integrated. You need to have
control.
People working with you. You have to have the workers. Now, when we realize that, it's like, hey, so we have the workers, that's great, et cetera. But in order to really transform the lives, pay is not the only piece, and I'm sure we'll discuss more about that later, but clearly pay is part of it. Yeah. And if we have to pay more, well, we need to get something in exchange. And the company is based on what we call the giving and demanding. So we're going to demand better work, but we're going to give you a lot more for that better work. Ended up with have best people in the industry, but because of that, we also have the best product in the industry. Because of that, we have a brand. And now we're able to integrate the whole thing from actually the moment we plant the seed to the moment we give it to a customer anywhere in the US. Now, we've been around for 32 years. For around 27 of the 32, we were a snacking tomato company. By the way, you might have heard about the Cherubs, Glorious, Constellation. We're the largest snacking tomato company, I think, on Earth, by the way. But around 5 years ago, we decided, hey, let's go and go for larger tomatoes, cucumbers, and peppers. And I know that might sound easy. It's a whole different ballgame of complication. Okay. Yeah. And that's what the journey we have been doing through right now.
I know that from my own little garden here in the country. Cherry tomatoes is the one thing I can grow season after season because the life cycle and conditions are such that I know I'll actually bring the fruit to harvest. Whereas with lettuce or bigger tomatoes, other things, rabbits get in the way or too much rain or what have you. So I can appreciate even at the most basic level how much of an accomplishment you've made there. Give us a sense of what, like you're vertical, but does that mean like you have a couple of major greenhouse plants in certain parts of the US, or are you all around the US? Where does the growing happen? Where does the packaging happen?
So we have over 1,000 acres of greenhouses. So this is like fully covered. Most of the operation is in Mexico. Mm-hmm. We also have operations in Arizona that we're opening now in the US. And when we started expanding, we also created a joint venture with a fantastic grower in Mexico to give us even more operations of high technology in different areas of the country. So making a long story short, right now, under our control, either fully owning or under the joint venture, which obviously we own part of it, we have, and I should know this at this point in time, but I think we have around 1,400 acres under greenhouse, plus the other 50 or so that we're going to be opening in Arizona at the end of this year.
And you're privately held or you're public?
Privately held.
Yeah, which helps, right? Going back to your earlier concern about chasing quarterly profits, it's nice not to be a slave to the investor relations community, probably.
Yeah, it helps. But one thing that's super interesting, it became a bit too easy. Because we have fantastic private owners who are not demanding any specific results on a quarterly basis, et cetera. So part of what I had to do is to get to the companies to say, hey, if we want to transform the lives of the agricultural workers in North America beyond our workers, so it's great that we're touching 6,000 lives. That's awesome. I love it. There are 10 million workers. So if we want to touch 10 million workers, we need to show that we have a fantastic business model that people can copy.
They can scale.
And to have a little business model that people can copy, we need to make good profit. We have to grow. We have to do all that. Because again, that's a way that people will copy you. Everyone has the benefit or the lack to have an owner that like the one we have who is not demanding quarterly results. Others do need the quarterly results. We know you can deliver that. That was a
And I know, so the ownership, this is a philosophical commitment they've made in creating NatureSweet and making it the sort of leading brand that it is. Can you speak a little bit about that? Like, are they like hippies from the 70s counterculture generation, or are they just maniacal philanthropists who want to raise the quality of life for workers, or what infuses that philosophy?
The owner, by the way, started with a company in San Antonio, which is where we're headquartered, with Picante Salsa. The owner sold it to Campbell's in the 90s.
Yep.
I should know the date, by the way, but rough, sometime in the 90s. And then he took that and he started creating new companies, mainly in the food arena. When he got into NatureSweet, he got very interested in the fact that, hey, we can make a difference in the agriculture. And he has been in... He's from Texas, so he has ranches in Mexico, also here. So he was really attuned with the tough lives of agricultural workers in North America. Yeah. One of the things that he wanted to make sure was that people look at your eyes when you walk around, which is something you don't see in Latin America or in the U.S. for that sake. Workers are normally looking down in agriculture. So one of the things he wanted to see was, can we build a company where people look up? And that was his big thing. Happy and proud, you need to look up. You need to be happy and proud, you need to look up. Yeah. So, and that's why he kept this company. He divested everything else. Now he's dedicating all his life to transform San Antonio into a culinary destination in the US and a few other things. But he kept NatureSweet. He was really in love with this idea of we're changing lives.
Yeah, remind me of his name, because he's the one behind the Pearl, right?
Yes, it's Keith Goldsberry.
Yes, because we had, I mentioned you offline, we had the head of the Culinary Institute of America down there. And I came to her because when I visited the Pearl refurbished area of San Antonio, it was just astonishing. His visionary commitment to transforming that space, to bringing people in and celebrating the traditions and the culture there was profound. So I didn't even connect the dots before this interview that that's where NatureSweet ties in. So we like Kit Goldsberry and what he's done. And also, I guess it's his now past ex-wife who's deceased who started the museum down there as well. There's a beautiful contemporary art museum in the Riverwalk area.
Yeah, they're super committed to the area.
Yeah. So ESG, environment, social governance, the topic can be fraught now for leaders, for politicians, for business leaders. I think one is either for it or not, but I'm a believer in that's the most responsible businesses are focused on it, acknowledge it and address it. I wonder how if you are challenged by any constituents or stakeholders around that concept and how you address it. Or is it such that you're so strong and great at what you're doing, nobody ever challenges those values and those commitments?
Yeah, so nobody is. Because at the end of the day, take all the politics aside. So what are we trying to do? So let's start with the S, which is we do ESG, but let's start with the S, which is the biggest part of the equation.
Yeah.
Our commitment is to treat people with dignity. That's it. We want to treat people with dignity. We always say that we're not a nice company. We're a fair company. So if you want to work hard, this is a place for you.
Right.
And by the way, you're going to be rewarded for that. And you're going to be handsomely rewarded for that. If you don't want to work hard, by the way, there are a lot of other really good companies for you, but not this one. And in fact, around 60% of our people, agricultural workers make, is a bonus that is based on their own productivity and their own quality. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, if you do the math, we pay around 40% more than the median of the industry.
Wow.
That all comes from that bonus. Yeah. So again, it's a deal. Yeah. So I have a deal with you that you work hard, you'll be rewarded.
Yeah.
So who can be against that? That's kind of a hard thing to be against.
Yeah.
So that you keep working on. So what else do we do that we talk about the social side? So every one of our plants have doctors and psychologists on site. Because we want to make sure that our people are healthy and that our people, both in mental and physical. We realize, I'm going to keep telling you this, our safety record is around 40 times better than the average of the agricultural industry in the US.
Wow.
Who would be against keeping your people safe? And for us, the way we see it is that's our responsibility to their families. So they're sending us their moms, kids, dads. The least we can do is send them back the same way. For us, it has to be basic. Yeah. Then we realized that women in Mexico had a hard time, this was several years ago, actually valuing themselves and really making them count. So we started with a program that lasts 6 months of teaching them self-respect and how to develop themselves, et cetera. Then we realized that, okay, that was great, but if the communities and the men were not really paying attention to that, that didn't work. So we started teaching that in the communities. Again, who could be against people developing themselves? Right. We have now, we started with elementary, but now we're in middle school and high school where we were able to teach people middle school and high school and give them their diplomas. This year we started with, we have a program with over 30 associates going through now college in the facility. So we bring the University of Guadalajara to come and teach them. So, and I can keep going and going and going, but the whole social part for us is like, okay, who could be against that? Which, by the way, at the end of the day, means that my turnover is around 0.9% per year, per month, in an industry that is 200 to 250%. So again, had to be against that when it's not affect, and that gives you better quality. Then in the environment, okay, we have everything at the greenhouses, which means that we use less water, we use better resources, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Again, and by the way, that also gives you significantly better product. So nothing to be against that. Right. And then in governance, okay, I'm assuming no one should be against having good governance in a company, so you know what whatever number we're reporting is the right number. So the way we see it is this is very basic, and we're not trying to get into any political statement or grandiose things. It's, we're just trying to do the right thing. And by the way, has a name now, ESG. And in fact, when we went for the B Corp certification, one of the things we wanted to do was to figure out what areas we were missing. And we could figure out, we had a couple of areas we could honestly sharpen. But again, this is not about how many stripes we want or how logo we want to put in the package, which in fact, we're not going to put the B Corp in the package. It's more on just do the right thing, should help the company.
Remind our listeners about briefly what a B Corp is and why it matters to you.
We have this commitment, which again is our purpose of transforming the lives of the agricultural workers in North America. So around 10 years ago, I know I should know the timing, by the way, but long ago, we helped found the Equitable Food Initiative, EFI. And what that did was to give the playbook. So this is how you treat associates. This is how you have great quality product.
Mm-hmm.
That helped. And now we have around 60,000 workers in North America that are operating in EFI certified facilities. And remember, we're 6,000. So that means that, hey, we were able to 10X that thing. Then in 2020, one of the largest customers in the US decided to go fair trade. They wanted to see if fair trade made sense. They were all desperate because this came from the CEO and said, okay, how do we get this done? It's too much volume, et cetera. And one of them, one of the procurement people in this customer, had been in our facilities and said, hey, I know that Nature Seed guys are not fair trade certified. They can do it in minutes. So they called us. We got into an agreement. We called fair trade. It wasn't minutes, but in a few weeks, by the way, we got fair trade certified. And with that, we realized, okay, so we might have a responsibility here, because then the test this customer did worked really well and started asking other people to be certified. So I said, okay, so what can we do to A, become better, B, claim to the world that we're something that we cannot ever lose again. So we're now driving up that responsibility. Yeah. And now start helping the industry change. And that's how we ended up in B Corp. So B Corp is probably the strongest certification on ESG. Yeah. It's not done by facility. So EFI and Fairtrade is by facility. B Corp is for the total company, which is a big deal for us because that means that you keep it or you lose it for the company.
Mm-hmm. No matter if you're in Mexico or US or Canada.
Regardless of where you are. I love for trade and EFI, obviously, by the way, but if one facility goes down, no one will notice because I have others. So you can, and that's some gaming that you see in the industry that you have one facility certified and you claim it. B Corp, it's the company. So it's the big deal. And now with that broad statement out there in the world, now we're accountable. So people can hold us accountable to who we are. So that's why for us, I know it took me a long time, but that's why B Corp for us is so important, because it proves that there's a false choice between being profitable, growing, and doing the right thing. So B Corp shows you that you're doing the right thing. But the other is this statement that will hold us accountable in front of everyone, that we cannot stumble.
Yeah, and your employees and your stakeholders are all helping you sort of self-regulate and keep yourselves honest, which is great. Absolutely. It doesn't get much more transparent than that in terms of governance, right?
That that's the idea. So right now, we're on this together. And if we ever see anybody do something that doesn't match, I have now thousands of people who raise their hand and say, okay, sorry, that doesn't make sense. So yeah. How better can it be? Now I have thousands of people helping me run the company. It's much easier.
one minor or very narrow question on the environmental piece is, do you have proprietary technologies, or are you pretty much able to run your greenhouses and your processing with off-the-shelf technologies?
Yeah, it's off-the-shelf technologies. What we have is we have great people. So our growers, so if you go back, you have, they always call the quality of a tomato, of anything, by the way, in produce, comes from three things. What are the genetics? What are your growing conditions? And what is your supply chain? The supply chain really doesn't help, but can really mess things up. So let's go to the other two, genetics and growing. Genetics, we work with all the key seed companies in the world. Mm-hmm. We're big enough, and we're also, let's say, more than ethical, so they trust us on giving us their product. We have good R&D facilities where we help co-develop the seeds. So at the end of the day, we get a ton of exclusivity in the best seeds in the world. Mm-hmm. And then it goes back all to growing, which goes back to people. So that's why, for me, it's not technology, it's people. We have the best people. We have growers who have been with us for 20 years. Yeah. Come on, who's going to teach them how to grow a tomato? They have seen it all the good things we have done, the awful things we have done. They know them all. They help us get the great tomatoes. And one area which is very interesting, so, and the words come from someone else in the produce industry, not from me, but it was very interesting. There's been a ton of capital being invested in the produce industry behind technology, but forgetting in what business you're in. Yeah. So if you're in the produce business and use technology to become better, perfect. If you believe you're in technology business, and oh, by the way, I have a produce thing in the side, that's billions of dollars of wealth that have been erased in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
We have, and by the way, I know I glance over technology. Hey, we 2 years ago, we put artificial intelligence to help us do a better yield forecasting. I can go on and on and on technology that we use to do things better. And if I don't say that, my engineering head will really shoot me. So so really, by the way, we have a ton of technology, but the technology is to serve a purpose, which is we sell the best products in the industry. That's what we need the technology. I don't care about the technology per se. I just want the best products in the industry.
Yeah. Well, you saved me my last question, because I was going to ask you about AI, and you've addressed that. So your engineer or your head of technology doesn't have to worry. But I do like to ask my guests a concluding question, which we describe as sort of pearls of wisdom. And I wonder, you've given many today, including the reference earlier about formulas. But do you have any sort of words or pearls of wisdom that you give regularly, either to your own children, to your colleagues, or that you hear regularly, mantra-like, that you have coming out of your mouth regularly about success in life and in careers?
So I'll start with a very broad, is that don't be afraid. Yeah. And for me, the biggest piece, which I do tell my kids all the time, is what's the choice that you're facing right now? Yeah. And it's dramatically easier to understand what you need to do when you understand what are the choices you're making. Mm-hmm. A lot of people assume the status quo is not a choice, but it's always a choice. That means you're choosing to keep doing what you're doing instead of changing. Yeah. So what I'm always telling my kids and everyone in the office is, I go back to, so what's the choice? What's the choice we have in front of us? What if we do X? What if we do Y? What happens then? Yeah. And so that's one big thing for me. And
yeah, conversely, if you don't make that choice, then where are you?
Bingo. Which for me, it's actually making a choice. You make the choice of not making a choice. That's the whole point. And I'm a bit really big on personal accountability. Mm-hmm. So my kids can like, this is happening. It's like, and my answer is always, so what are you going to do about it? Yeah. Because whining and complaining is super easy and everyone can do it. What are you going to do about it? Yeah. And then it goes back to, hey, if it's under your control, fix it. If it's under your influence, well, do something. If there's nothing you can do about it, well, let it go. So, but it's a big deal of what's a choice and what are you going to do about it?
Yeah. I'm smiling because we talked off camera about my husband being from San Antonio and my having spent a lot of time there with my stepfather when he was ill. But Harlan, my husband, taught me this wonderful expression that I associate with San Antonio, which is on accountability. It's like, with a bird in mind, don't swoop and poop, because birds will swoop down, poop, and fly off. That's not fine in a business setting or when you're in a situation with group decision-making. You can have your opinion, you can critique, but then you need to suggest a solution or a way forward, because just complaining doesn't help anything, right? If anything, it makes matters worse. So we say no swoop and poop in our house.
Okay, I love it. I'm going to take that. I like it. Absolutely.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank Rodolfo Spielman today for joining us. He's the CEO of NatureSweet, one of my favorite tomatoes, and part of the produce section. And I hope, Rodolfo, you have great success and continue to grow the company and scale that kind of culture for workers across North America. It's very inspiring.
Hey, Toby, thanks a lot. Thanks for the invitation. And we are just starting. So.
Thank you for listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick. Please share your comments and questions with Toby via Twitter at @TUsnick or LinkedIn at Toby Usnick. And thank you for sharing The Caring Economy with your friends and colleagues.